गुरवे चंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय साध भक्ताय नमो नमः। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू। गुड मॉर्निंग फ्रॉम अलाचा एंड वेरी हैप्पी टू बी अगेन विद इनिस्ट गोस्टे ऑल टुगेदर। तदात्म्य संग की जाए। एंड वी हैव हैड वेरी नाइस गैदरिंग येस्टरडे। मे बी सम ऑफ यू वर एबल टू कनेक्ट ऑनलाइन टॉकिंग ऑन सेल्फ लव इन भक्ति पार्ट वन। टुडे वी हैव पार्ट टू इन द इवनिंग। टुमोरो पार्ट थ्री। एंड इट फेल लाइक ए वेरी नेसेसरी टॉपिक फॉर एट लीस्ट फॉर मी, बट फॉर्चुनेटली फॉर सम अदर्स एज वेल टू touch upon and find not only the similarities but the connection and implication between how self-loving must include bhakti and how real bhakti must include self-love, and the two of them are not actually, they're actually inseparable. And bring in those words, using that terminology, bring into the picture another way of speaking about integrative bhakti, wholesome bhakti, healthy paradigms for approaching spiritual life. So yeah, it was a healing gathering, and I look forward will be so today and tomorrow as well. So Istagosti ki jai. We'll start Istagosti. As I like to always think of, Istagosti means not Q&A merely. I put Q&A in the flyer because some people may not have a clue what Istagosti means. But it's not limited to Q&A. I mean, there are questions, there are answers, so we try to answer something. But ultimately, the very word istagosti is very interesting, and I think we have talked about it, but let me share a few words before we go to the official questions. Istagosti. So gosti implies like a gathering of people, no? Like when we hear this word goshti-anandi, or different rasa goshti, also in the Bhagavatam, the rasa lila is described as rasa goshtyam, you know, like a gathering or like a meeting in the context of rasa. So goshti implies a reunion of people around or revolving or constellating around ishta. So constellation about the center, so to say, the actual worshipable deities. That sometimes you have heard the word ishtadev. So ishta means like worshipable, that which is worthy of our love and dedication, that which is the center, the magnetic, all attractive, we will call Sri Krishna. So Ishtagosti basically means that. Let's revolve around a common center, or let's get together in a way that we acknowledge our role, our interconnection among each other with a common center, and we are constellating around it. Whatever questions come and go, answers may be there, and hopefully, but the spirit of Istagosti means that basically. Let's constellate around our common center. And whatever we share, whatever comes and goes, is for that purpose only. It's for the idea of it's investing ourselves further in this cause of divine love, unconditional love, another way of talking about the universal center of reality. Krishna being non-different from love, love being non-different from unconditional love, and therefore the center being non-different from that. And we trying to, yeah, circumambulate, no? Somehow, constellate around or circumambulate. Sometimes we hear this word parikram, which means to walk around, and many times parikram is a way of expressing honor and respect for something worshipable, and we walk around that. We walk around the altar, the temple, the deity, a sacred person, Govardhan. And so parikram means that, no? To circumambulate something that is worshipable. So Ishtagosti means basically that, no? We get together to acknowledge our constellating around this common center. And even the questions that will come will come, hopefully, and the answers as well, from that spirit of revolving in a re reverential, loving way around the common center. That's why, interestingly, we have terms like pariprajna, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna says, tadvidhi pranipatena pariprajnena sevaya. So we should, our inquiry should be pariprajna. There's one microphone on there. As we have parikram, again, parikram means circumambulation physically, and pariprajna means an inquiry, which is like revolving, it's like comprehensive. It's like a way of circumambulating through our inquiry, so to say. It's a way of establishing the spirit of istagosti. So anyhow, a few reflections that came to mind in this moment about what we are supposed to do here and what we want to remind each other that we want to do in sacred gathering, in sacred istagosti. So let's say we will go to the questions, and I see Rasangi is raising her hand, but with your permission, Rasangi, and with Anutam Chitra's permission, because I'm seeing her hand raised, so you may recall I have this question from Daniel from last week, remember, that I mentioned that we will start with that one, because also it's a question revolving around Ekadasi. And today happens to be Ekadasi, at least on this part of the planet, so it's an appropriate inquiry. So I'll make the question, I have it. He's not able to connect live, but he watches the episodes after. So he sent the question in a written way. I'll read it, and we'll try to say something about it. He says, I have heard a few explanations of the significance of Ekadasi, as well as the benefits of fasting on those days. However, when I observe Ekadasi, I feel disconnected from a purpose. More often than not, it feels that I am observing it through blind faith, that it will somehow please Krishna to do so and may benefit me as well. I am aware that this is not an ideal approach, but it still seems better than neglecting the observance altogether. Can you please explain to me the importance of Ekadasi? Is it even beneficial to myself or pleasing to Krishna if I am only observing it in this sort of ritualistic way? So that's a question, very appreciated question. Thank you so much, Daniel. So let's try to say something about it. It's an interesting question. And also, of course, I'll try to address the Ekadasi issue, so to say, but also not limit that to Ekadasi, no? But to whatever we do, so to say, we happen to be doing in the context of Krishna Bhakti, and how to do it in a way that is meaningful, very basically, purposeful, and not merely mechanical or catatonical, if you will, a catatonic repetition of something which must please Krishna, something like that, no? With this type of, I will say, mechanistic faith, no? Like, I know that by doing this, Krishna must be pleased. No matter what's my intention, something like that. No, I'm not investing an intention in what I'm doing, but I know that what I'm doing pleases him. That can be a complicated stance, no? Because, yeah, we can just end up practicing, following a Ekadasi or anything in a way that is devoid of heart, devoid of purpose, devoid of intention, and bhakti is intentional. Bhava Grahi Janardana. Krishna Janardan, he is known as the one who takes the essence of our intention. That's what he considers in the offering, in the act that we are offering. Like I was the other day, in the Spanish Istagosti on Thursdays, we were talking about the verse that I happened to read recently from the Bhagavad Gita, which I learned in the past by heart, but somehow I lost sight of its importance in connection to this topic. Specifically, I remember some months ago we talked about, for example, many times about chanting the name and chanting rounds and the issue of chanting a certain number of rounds and finishing the number, and even devotees that are overtly attached to that and thinking, okay, if I just do my 16 rounds per day and four regulative principles at the end of this lifetime, Krishna is forced to take me to Golok, so to say. And then I come with this verse, which is verse 28 from 17th chapter of the Gita. Asrada yahutam datam tapastaptam kritam chayat asaditi uchate parto na chattat pratyanoiha. That's a very interesting verse because there Krishna is saying, whatever is being done without faith, asradaya, without shraddha, asradaya, hutam datam, now whether it is sacrifice or charity, kritam chayat, whatever you are doing without faith, it's asat, Krishna says. It's unreal, basically. Does not exist for me, Krishna is saying. Asaditi uchate parta nachatat pritinoiha. And that takes you nowhere, whether in this lifetime or the next. For those who say, in the next lifetime, Krishna is forced to take me to Golok if I bring him this number per day. But what about your faith? Where is your heart? Where is your intention? This verse clearly debunks this myth, so to say, clearly shows if you don't have faith, if the heart is not in a certain place, and the intention is not there, that's taking you nowhere. Probably you are even probably increasing your anarthas. That can happen. That will be one interpretation I will make of the term that Viswanath Chakravarti Thakur made of the four types of anarthas, one of them being bhakti-yuta anartha. So bhakti-yuta anartha means anarthas which come from bhakti. Of course, not from bhakti itself. Bhakti is meant to uproot anarthas. But when you approach bhakti with the wrong attitude or the wrong perception, that can become a source of anartha in itself. Because you are increasing, again, your mechanistic endeavors. You are thinking that God, you are projecting a false idea about God, that Krishna is forced to give me this if I get to give this number. So you are projecting a completely wrong idea of who Krishna is. So you are increasing all these anarthas and misconceptions, all in the context of doing bhakti. You follow my point? So that's a way of understanding bhakti yuta anartha. We briefly touched upon that yesterday also, mentioning how bhakti without self-love is not bhakti. But we can practice that so-called bhakti and become more and more traumatized and troubled. So that becomes a source of anarthas. Again, we are increasing our trauma, our conditioning, our prejudice, our bias, our stagnation, while thinking that we are engaging in bhakti. And Rupa Goswami says this in his own way. If you go to verse number 2 of Upadeshamrita, what does he say there? He uses the term niyamagraha, atyahara prayasascha prayalpo niyamagraha, janascha laulyamcham sadbid bhakti binashyati. Say, if you want, I'm putting it in that way, if you want to destroy your bhakti, you can do these six things, so to say. Now, of course, he's not proposing destroy your bhakti, but it's a way of saying, now, there are six things that will really get in the way of bhakti. One of them is niyamagraha, which has two meanings, of course. One is reject all rules and regulations and become like a rebel without a cause, whimsical, and just nobody tells me what to do, and I create my own version of everything. Or niyamagraha also means you follow all rules and regulations without having an idea, a clue, what's the purpose of them. You follow things externally, mechanistically, superficially, repeating things catatonically. That's according to Rupa Goswami, niyamagraha, and that affects your bhakti negatively. That convinces you of a version of bhakti that is not bhakti. In that sense, destroys bhakti. No? It gives you a sense of, I'm practicing bhakti, I'm doing all this, but you are doing everything devoid of intention, devoid of heart in that case. So instead of melting your heart through bhakti, our heart may become more hardened, our structures become more rigid, we become more and more narrow-minded, fanatical, sectarian, in brief, a public danger to society, so to say, in the name of bhakti, right? So This is my introduction to the question of Daniel on Ekadasi, because it applies to Ekadasi and to anything else, everything else. So yeah, we are not meant to do Ekadasi as just some, again, bi-monthly or bi-weekly is in English, fortnightly stuff that happens. And oh yeah, tomorrow I cannot eat grains. Okay, I won't eat grains, and Krishna will be happy with me because of that. I will tolerate not eating pizza for 2 days a month, and that will really benefit me, or some whatever. Each one has their own version of that. But that's not the idea, of course, no? Ekadasi, in one sense, is not about fasting. One Srila Prabhupada say Ekadasi is not about fasting. Ekadasi is about feasting. And when we say feasting, we are not saying just make arrangements to eat three times more and more fancy preparations than usual. Not the type of feast. But feasting internally, feasting in terms of entering into especially more sacred space that we may usually enter. Ideally, a day like Ekadasi, and you have in different traditions days like this that comes every month or every few months, you have Lent, like in Christianity, certain periods where we are expected to interrupt your normal dynamics. That's a very way to put it. We were talking about that some weeks ago in Arkansas with the devotees. This idea came of, we were talking about Achintya Veda Veda Tattva, and Srila Siddhar Maharaj defines this Veda Veda, one and different, as bipolar. Now, that's bipolar, not doesn't necessarily mean something bad. No, bipolarity means like you have these two polarities, you know, oneness and difference. So our metaphysical doctrine is bipolar in nature. But so we should represent that bipolarity in a certain way also, not by becoming bipolar in the negative clinical psychological sense, but bipolar in the sense we shouldn't limit ourselves to be unipolar in the sense of we have our way of living life and we generally do things in the same way every day on some level. We have some structure, I do this every day tomorrow. And there's a way that we get accustomed to that and that becomes our lives. And that can be a danger in itself because it becomes too much unnuanced, too much unipolar, and there is no place for interruption, so to say. There's no place for being interrupted by wonder and who knows what. And forcing ourselves in a healthy way to perceive reality from a different place, space. So days like Ekadasi, ideally, are meant for that, are meant to break the unipolarity twice a month. and you have that on that day. And that's why I'm not saying you have to do like that. But for example, you may know that in some groups in our tradition on Ekadasi, devotees do not sleep for one the night. And of course, I'm not here, you stop sleeping on the nights of Ekadasi, but understand the purpose of that. You're kind of interrupting a normal cycle for some people that won't be healthy in terms of health, but it's a way of interrupting the normal things that you do and spending some special attention and effort, not eating or eating differently, not sleeping or stopping certain activities and focusing in a particular way or some things, those 2 days a month, like changing the polarity, so to say, to balance the polarities. Because if you are just unipolar, that's not very balanced because there's no second thing to put in the scale on the other side. So Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says in chapter 6, yuktahara biharasya yukta chistasya karmasu, and so on. You should be balanced in your sleeping, in your eating, in your recreation. So also a way to understand that verse is not only be balanced in terms of always sleep the same quantity of time, but also be careful of not becoming unipolar in all those things. And sometimes you have to know when to interrupt those dynamics, invoke new dynamics that by force, by force of the circumstance you yourself arrange, take you to a different place of seeing things in a new way. So again, with this, I'm not saying you have to do like this or like that, but these are special days a month that ideally, as much as time allows and the life dynamics allow, we can make some special arrangements, whatever. You can do some special, again, ritual or offering or prayer, spend special time. Some may like to fast, to not sleep, to do kirtan all night. I mean, it can take so many forms, but it's a way to, again, break this unipolarity, bring this healthy bipolarity, and invest yourself with a special intention. Maybe you want to put yourself a special dress on that day for Krishna's pleasure. No, like a way of creating the consciousness, today is a special day. Today will be a special moment, or I am entering into a special space. And you even can create in your house or your place, special place for the, given ideas or examples, of course. But that's the point of Ekadasi. That's my point. It's not just, okay, today I cannot eat grains till tomorrow. And by doing that, Krishna will be pleased. That's very, in comparison to what I just described, I hope you can sense how different that is. So yeah, Ekadasi is a day to increase our purpose, to renew our intention, our sankalpa, to focus on a particular motivation we have, or we want to have, we want to offer. And that was brings purpose and meaning to a day like Ekadasi. It's not just, again, stop eating or stop doing that or do more of that. It's not increasing or decreasing quantities. But doing that, even if you do that, doing that with an understanding of the purpose of that and how in different traditions this dynamics, disruptions exist to take us out of the comfort zone, to take us out of the predictable ways in which our day and life happen, which again, I'm not against a level of that. I talk on radical personalism about chaos and order, as you may recall. So we all need some order. If there's zero order, that's too much unpredictability. But if you don't balance order with chaos, that becomes dangerous, equally dangerous. Too much order becomes close to a totalitarian regime. There is no place for innovation, for surprise, for adventure, which basically means there is no place for Krishna. Because he is surprise personified. He is adventure personified. He's the supreme non-conformist. So days like Ekadasi are for that, no? Like force yourself to be non-conformist and voluntarily step out of your comfort zone and do something that you are not used to do every day. And by this, I'm not saying do something crazy, nonsensical stuff, of course, but in a way that takes you deeper to whatever you are doing on a daily basis. And I think we all know that if we make some concerted effort to create special environment on those days, that will have a special impact on that, on us also. It's not like, oh, it's the same. No, if you make some special effort to create an environment to focus, to have the time to go deeper, and hopefully even you can do it with other people that also is aligned in that principle. So even if you are by yourself, you know, oh, today my tribe, so to say, is specially aligned and they are doing special circle of prayer, whatever may be happening. You can even organize that among your group, among family. And that even creates even more powerful alliance. Like, okay, I'm by myself in my room, in my house, but I'm not by myself. I know we are all meeting in that particular space and place that Ekadasi offers, like a portal. So, and of course, one more thing before concluding is that, as we know, Ekadasi can be understood from different levels. Again, some may understood it more negatively in terms of, on Ekadasi, you cannot do this. No, like Ekadasi is a day where you cannot do some things, instead of, I can do something extra in a positive term. But Ekadasi is not about do not eat grain because the personified sin is there, and if you eat there, something negative will happen. Because in that case, it depicts Ekadasi as a negative day, no? like inauspicious, basically. A day to be careful, especially paranoid, probably. But because it's, yeah, they to be especially careful, but especially careful in terms of providing and offering ourselves in a positive way. So Srila Sila Maharaj will give this mystical example. He will say, Ekadasi has to do with the position of the moon, and the moon is the presiding deity of the waters. And on a day like Ekadasi, the waters are especially moving and agitated by the position of the moon. And our body is full of water, 70% of that. So the bodies of our water are especially agitated on Ekadasi. So certain grains are, the grains are not prescribed as to not increase even more the movement of those waters, and that may agitate us, but that's just a very superficial meaning, he says. On top of that, Krishna's spiritual body is also made of transcendental water inside, and the waters of Krishna's transcendental body become more agitated in ekadasi, which means he's more willing to receive service. He has a bigger tendency to enjoy an ekadasi. So we have the possibility of offering ourselves in service for his pleasure on that day of special necessity. And when we know, when we offer service in a moment of special necessity, that brings a higher remuneration, which, and the higher remuneration is further mercy and energy to further offer in service. So he will explain ekadasi like that. That's what ekadasi is about. It's a day where Krishna is especially in need, basically, because he's especially agitated and in need of service. And therefore, that offers you a special possibility to offer yourself in service to that need. And a way to do that may be, as I am mentioning, try to craft a special day or space in that day so you can actually provide that type of intention and service to him. So basically, that's what Ekadasi is about. And I trust that each of us, in one way or another, can, if we are sincere, will can make some arrangements for that to happen, even though we may not be able to do that on every single day of our month. A few times a month, these type of powerful reminders and immersions, of course, create enough samskaras to inspire us till the next Ekadasi, so to say, and so on and so forth. And eventually, we will realize, wow, I never thought of Ekadasi like this. Now this is becoming feasting. And now we would understand why Prabhupada said that. Ekadasi is not about fasting, but feasting. But provided you make the necessary arrangements and approach it with the proper attitude. So that's what I will encourage, instead of just remain, I don't know, complacent and just following it ritualistically. And something will come from that. Yeah, probably something will come from that. But part of that something is also that you get attached to do things in that way. And the more you do that, the more you reinforce that message and samskar, and you end up being a robot, basically. And we don't want that. So better to make whatever arrangements we can make on special days like that, organize our month around that, if you will, created those two sacred occasions, and being able to draw the purpose that can be drawn from those moments if we have the proper focus and orientation. It may take energy and time to do that, but it's worth it trying. So anyhow, some thoughts on that. Of course, so much more can be said, but I think that's a good way to approach it. And again, this is not only limited to Ekadasi, but to whatever vows or commitments we take in our bhakti tradition. So I hope that helps. Daniel is not connected here. He will let me know eventually if that helped at all. But I hope that helped to the ones that are connected here now. So let's go to the next question with Rasangi. You can unmute yourself, please.
Hare Bol, Maharaj, so nice to be with you and everybody. And I love that answer. I think you've just changed my whole mood for about Ekadasi.
Yeah, that was intention, to change Rasangi's whole mode about the Ekadasi.
After all these years, who could have thought? Anyway, and I was thinking that for me, my structure is so important, and getting out of it is disturbing. And yet, unpredictability and change is a big part of life. So becoming comfortable with more spontaneity and change is a gift, right? It's such a gift.
Yeah.
I try to remember that. And it brings joy. Being a spontaneous brings me joy. And I loved your class last night. I look forward to more today. I think it was soothing and comforting and just made us feel happy to know that it's okay to care for ourselves and love ourselves. And we're not in Maya if we feel that way. And I have a couple of questions, but I'll just ask one.
Okay.
Right now, you talk about in the non-dual chapter, there cannot be personality without non-duality. I know it's really important. And I'm trying to understand that we're studying it, a group I'm in. And you talk about, I know it's really important in my development and my bhakti and my way of being in the world. And yet it's kind of mind-boggling still to me. And so you talk about we need to train our mind in non-dual thinking. So what does that mean? How do we train our minds in non-dual thinking, like day to day?
Okay, thank you so much for the question. Yeah, we touched briefly upon that yesterday. On the importance, what does it mean to train our minds in non-dual thinking? Well, to begin with, I would say the first step is to understand that, at least for us, we are talking here in the context of our tradition, but of course it goes even beyond our tradition. We have to acknowledge that reality is non-dual in nature. And non-dual doesn't mean impersonal. Okay, I'm making that clear because in the devotee's audience, sometimes to hear words like non-duality means Advaita. Literally, Advaita means non-duality. So we'll say, oh, that's Advaita Vedanta, that's Shankaracharya, that's Mayavada, that's impersonalism. That's the exact opposite to our tradition, and we become all fired up. But the point is that every mystical tradition, every Vaishnava Sampradaya, includes a form of non-duality. If you analyze even the names of the Vaishnava Sampradayas, not Shankar, but Vaishnava Sampradayas, all of them mostly speak about that. Shuddha Dvaita, Vishishta Dvaita, Dvaita Dvaita. Oh, that word Advaita is there. Ours is a Chintya Bheda Abhed, which is another way of saying, when you say Abhed, you're saying non-difference. It's a way of saying non-duality. So reality is non-dual. The Srimad Bhagavatam mentions that basically in the beginning, in one of its most important verses that Jiva Goswami takes and unpacks in the form of his Shatsandarbha. You can imagine how important that verse is, that the whole Shatsandarbha comes as a byproduct of that. Vedanti tat tattva vidas tattvam yajnanam advayam. Generally, we know more the last sentence, Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavan iti shabdyate. But we shouldn't skip the first two, which says, Tattva Advaigyan Tattva. Bhagavatam says, reality, Tattva means reality here, is Advaigyan, is non dual consciousness. Reality is non dual consciousness. That's Bhagavatam, one line. That's Srimad Bhagavatam. At the end of the Bhagavatam, basically says the same. The whole topic of this book says, has been non-dual reality. That's the main theme of the Bhagavatam. So when we talk about non-dual thinking, we are talking about studying the Bhagavatam, basically. So training our minds in non-dual thinking begins by acknowledging that reality is non-dual and understanding. Non-dual means there are not two realities. They are not separate, two separate realities. One reality here, one reality there, another reality there. There's only one reality, and everything is connected to that. If we want to call Krishna the ultimate reality, but everything else, we, the world of matter, every other soul, whatever exists, does not exist in isolation of that reality. You follow my point? There's nothing separated. Separatedness is the opposite of non-duality. And the Bhagavatam also speaks about that. Bhayam dvitiya abhinivesatasya. Famous verse of the Bhagavatam, 11th canto. Dvitiya means dualism, which is another form, say, duality, which is the opposite of non-duality. So Bhagavatam is saying, duality means like fragmented consciousness. I'm seeing different things disconnected from each other. Separated. I'm seeing myself separated from my source, separated from everything else. I'm losing sight of the interconnectedness of everything. And I know in practice we may not have that mystical vision, but we really witness the interwovenness of everything. But at least we should begin by admitting that in theory. It sounds not so much, but it's important. At least to train our minds means to educate ourselves to begin with, sambandha, to acquire knowledge, educate ourselves, and grasp, at least in theory to begin with, how reality is non-dual, how everything exists in connection with everything else. I mean, I'm not being here fancy and new agey. I'm quoting the Bhagavatam, right? So things do not exist as isolated units from each other. Everything is, in the words of my dear father, Richard Rohr, he will say, everything belongs. For me, that's a genius way of putting that in two words. Everything belongs, because nothing exists in separatedness. So everything belongs. So that's non-dual thinking, basically. Like, at least in theory, accepting that's how reality exists and operates. Things exist in connection. There's nothing isolated. That brings so much, at least for me, I will say, just to even know in theory that's how reality is, brings so much relief and support and grounding, because you know everything is related, connected. It's not that everything is going in its own direction, absolutely isolated, separated. Separatedness is the real problem. That's why the Bhagavatam say, when you fall into that separatedness, bhayam, fear comes, and all the things that come up from that, all the anarthas that we may refer to, are coming from this. If you want me to boil down these terms, I will say, first, according to our tradition, comes avidya. First, no, it's not chronological, but at one point in time. But first, avidya means lack of knowledge or ignorance, if you will, ignorance of who we are, so to say, of an ignorance of what everything is. So because of this avidya, dvitiya, because of ignorance comes this duality, this perception of things as separated from each other. Because of not knowing what is what comes dvitiya, no? Separatedness, dualism, dichotomy, fractured consciousness. Because of that, fear comes. Because I start to see things in terms of separation, groups, enemies, friends, disconnectedness. We lose sight of the harmonic connection with the whole. And from that fear, to cope with that fear, we engage in so many things that bring forth all the varieties of anarthas as we know them. You can call lust, anger, envy, greed, blah, blah, blah. All that comes from that fear would come from that perception of separatedness, which comes from avidya, from not knowing the reality of things. So, of course, the way to counteract that avidya is by vidya, by knowledge. By knowledge, instead of avidya and dvitiya, ignorance and duality, you have vidya, knowledge, and non-duality. As a byproduct of real knowledge, you realize, okay, everything is connected. We are all connected. That gives so much. Again, the Vedas say that, Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, in the language of the Vedas. There is only one family. That's another way of saying everything belongs. There's only one family, say the Veda. I'm quoting Vedas here, ancient Vedas. Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam. There is no more than one family. In other words, non-dual reality. There are not two families. Everything is part of the same family because everything is rooted, so to say, in the same mom and dad, rather than Krishna, so to say, our universal parents, put it as you like. And this is pervading all mystical traditions, this kind of universal intuition that every genuine wise person will arrive at. It's like on this foundation of non-duality, then there can be diversity on the basis of non-duality, as we were saying. On the basis of non-duality, we can relate to one another. Because non-duality means we do not exist as strangers to each other. We share a common bond. So that's actually what facilitates relating to each other. If I start with the foundation of dualism, each of us are alienated units from each other, you can imagine what type of relationship we will have, if you can call it relationship. So a preliminary factor for actual human interaction or any form of relationship is an acknowledgement of this foundation of non-duality, which in itself speaks about the relationality of everything. So those are words that probably we need to get more accustomed to include in our vocabulary. Reality is relational. Relational means it's two-way street. No? Everyone, we are affected by what the other does. The other is affected by what we do. And God himself, again, they are not like isolated people, indifferent people, impossible. Sometimes that's the word. God is not touched by whatever happens to anyone else. No, no, he's touched. He's affected. Of course, he doesn't mean that he's affected in the way we are affected. But if we are suffering, God's heart is touched, is affected by compassion, and so on. So yeah, I consider it very important. That's why I dedicated a whole chapter to non-dual thinking at the risk of being considered a potential Mayavadi or something in my community, because most of us do not speak too much about non-duality and do not understand it properly. And by not understanding it properly, we reject it altogether. And the result of rejecting non-duality is that you become a dualist. And that's a problem, I can tell you. And in the name of representing a non-dual tradition like ours, we end up representing it in such dual ways. Not only philosophically, but in the way we relate to each other, by the way we see reality, we live life dualistically. So training our minds in non-dual thinking, I will say, is, again, exposing our minds, our thinking processes to this type of narratives and thinking about that. And I'm trying to ruminate on that and trying to from that rumination and thinking, acting as if that's true, so to say. It is true. but acting on the basis of that orientation, so to say. Each one of our acts is based on some type of knowledge and information that orients our actions, and that brings up some fruits. That's what we call sambandha, vidya, and prayojan. So sambandha means you acquire certain orientation, some knowledge, then avideya, you act upon that. And then prayojan comes a result for that. So if our orientation or knowledge that orients our actions is based on dualism, okay, your actions will reflect that, and your fruit, what to speak. So it's important that we re-educate ourselves, we correct whatever needs to be corrected in our sambandha. The very word sambandha means everything is connected, right? Sambandha, bandha means bond, and sam means everything. So it's interesting because sambandha gyan is the knowledge that we receive to orient our practices, everything that we need to educate ourselves. But the very word sambandha gyan means the knowledge of the bondedness of everything. And on that basis, you are supposed to act on bhakti, avideya. Bhakti in practice is avideya. But the practice of bhakti is to be executed on the foundation of sambandha. Sambandha is a type of education that has to teach you everything is interconnected. Everything is bonding with it, everything. Everything belongs. Vasudhaiva kutumbakam, non-dual thinking. Use the word you want, but don't miss this important lesson, because if not, our practice of bhakti will be devoid of that and will be dualistic. We will be dualistic bhaktas, which is an oxymoron. It's a contradiction of terms. And you can imagine the twisted fruit of practicing bhakti with a dualistic perspective. You don't need to imagine. We have witnessed that on a daily basis in our lives or in other situations where you feel like that's who I'm becoming. How can such a noble and beautiful idea like Krishna consciousness be represented as such a sectarian, narrow-minded, elitist, racist ways? No, that's not Krishna bhakti. But many of us do that because I'm not saying they are bad people. It's just they don't have a proper foundation. They are not properly educated on the nature of reality, so to say. Reality is non-dual. So that's non-duality. Again, here we are not saying everything is Brahman and I'm God and you become one with that. We are not saying that. That's, as I put in my book, radical non-dualism. But we are for radical personalism, which includes a form of non-dualism, but the nuanced form of non-dualism, which allows for relationship, relationality. So yeah, that's what I will say today in that connection. It's an important topic.
Could I just clarify a little bit?
Yeah.
That, so it seems to me that if we become aware of our thinking, which we, it could need to be mindful, like going through my day,
yeah,
I can catch myself thinking dually and then change it, shift it, like let it go. Like that's kind of practicing, in my opinion. Like,
yeah, I mean, different people, different stages will take that to practice in a certain way. But yeah, we'll say first we try to drench ourselves, so to say, soak in these ideas gradually till they become like second nature. And as you said, they will start to, gradually will realize, okay, this starts to play out in my daily life, in how I relate to others. And as you say, one of the aspects will be I will detect the dualistic patterns when they are coming more easily by being reminded on a daily basis, hopefully, how reality is non-dual. So the more you incorporate this non-dual narrative, the more what is not that will show itself more evidently. And that's part of the process. But yeah, I will recommend, especially if we feel, I don't know, it's first time I'm hearing this stuff, maybe on a daily basis, one needs to remind oneself, okay, this is the nature of reality. Everything is connected. There is a common center. We are all part of one family, this, that, that. And then when you, yeah, relate to other people, life dynamics, okay, you will, all these things will start to come. But yeah, I think it's very important to create the union. Again, yoga, we practice yoga, bhakti yoga. Yoga means union. It's another way of saying stop the separatedness. There is already too much separatedness. The very Bhagavad Gita, if you want to take, interpret the text on a more symbolic level, which it can be done, you can see the first verse of the Gita, Dharma Kshetri Kurukshetri Samabhita Yujatsava Pandavas Mamakascha Bekima Kurubhata Samjaya. It speaks about, okay, here are the Kurus and the Pandavas. And Dhritarashtra is asking in a very partial way, what did my sons, no, and the sons of Dhritarashtra, the son of Pandu, sorry, did? So he, the way he expresses, and many commentators have made that clear, is this is the perfect example of the dualistic consciousness. Now, here you have enemies and friends, one, two armies against each other, and thinking, what did they do and my children? And they are not my children. Although he should consider, as we know, Dhritarashtra should have considered, the Pandavas are my children as well, because of what happened in their life. So the very Gita and the first verse is showing, on a symbolic level, this Kurukshetra battle is dualism. The battle in our own mind with these dual tendencies. And of course, how Krishna replies to that dualism, every single chapter of the Gita ends with the word yoga, right? Sankhya yoga, karma yoga, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga, bhakti yoga. Yoga, yoga means union, bonding, no? Bonding. Let's bring together things. It begins with separatedness, Kurus and Pandavas, dichotomy, fracture, dualism, then yoga, yoga, yoga. So basically that's the pattern. That's the universal pattern. Like separatedness, union. Of course, the highest form of union is love. That's why we embrace bhakti yoga. But all these forms of yoga are meant to bring some form of union, some form of reconciliation of reality, like bringing the separated, the abyss of separatedness, bringing it closer and closer and closer till there is no separatedness. And ultimately, that fusion or synthesis is bhakti, love. That's where you, there's no sense of separatedness, not in an impersonal way, but in love, you feel that there's no separatedness between what you love and yourself. It, in one sense, it's one. It's a dynamic one, oneness, right? That's the meaning of love ultimately. So, yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, Rasangi, for your question. So now we have Anutam Chitra raising her hand. We don't see the camera, but if we can hear you, that's okay. I cannot hear you. I see that you in the chat say mic drop. So I don't know if your mic actually dropped because I cannot listen. We cannot hear you. At least not me. I don't know you. No. No. I don't know if. Sorry. I don't know, Anutam Chitra, if you would prefer to send the written question in case your mic for some reason is not working. And meanwhile, I don't see any other raised hand. In case someone else has something or a comment or something you may like to add, you're back to Rasa, raise your hand. I cannot listen to you either.
I'm mute.
So now I know if it's my problem now. You are muted, back to Rasa.
Okay, there.
Yeah.
While you were responding with Rasangi, something came up with, I had a question. I kind of saw a relationship, you were speaking of Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojan. So do you see a relationship also with thinking, feeling, and willing with those three? It seems like thinking kind of ends or facilitates Sambandha, and feeling facilitates Abhideya, and willing facilitates Prayojan.
I don't know if you can explain that a little bit more, especially willing in connection to Prayojan.
Well, we inform, the more we understand things and contemplate things, then the more the relationship with things seems to become apparent. And like you were explaining, you know, to contemplate these ideas, these thoughts, to re-educate ourselves. And the result of the re-education would be a deepening or a bigger recognition of our connectedness with things. And then feeling would lead to action. You know, if we feel that something is true, or feeling as part of our inspiration kind of system, then we will act according to that.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't feel that much of a correspondence. I mean, I'm not saying there's no correspondence, but I don't feel comfortable like limiting the correspondence of Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojan to thinking, feeling, and willing, so to say. Because you can also relate willing, you can invert and say, no, Abhideya is more connected to willing, because after thinking, that informs my will and that makes me act in a certain way that takes me to feeling, which is the fruit of acting and willing in certain. I mean, one could make up for, in my opinion, again, the case for connecting all of the three with the other three in their own ways. So I'm not saying they are not connectable. I'm just saying I don't feel just comfortable limiting the connection to Sambandha is thinking, Sambandha is Abhideya is feeling, and Prayojan is willing, because I feel there's place for
all of them.
Understanding the others in their own nuanced way. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for sharing. So Anutam Chitra remains with her hands raised. So I don't know if that means you already now can ask your question.
Am I audible now, Maharaj?
Yes, now you are.
Oh. Yes, Maharaj. Actually, I need to give my laptop for servicing. That's why, I mean, the video is problematic, so I couldn't turn it on today.
No problem.
Yes, Maharaj. Yeah, so my question is, Maharaj, I think in one of the previous sessions, I think one person had already asked this question, but I think I would like to bring that up again in a way that makes sense to me. So, how free is our free will, Maharaj? Because I think I was recently, I had interacted with one astrologer, and he was emphasizing on how planets and then the corresponding deities play an important role in on an individual on all levels, be it physical, mental, social. So he even gave the example of Parikshit Maharaj, where he was saying that for him to be instrumental in eliciting such a spiritual exchange, it was possible because his planets were favorably arranged, and that is why he was able to actualize spiritually. And so on that note, Maharaj, I was wondering then, how do we know, or how do I know that I have a choice in whatever decisions we make? Because it sounds to me as if even devotional or spiritual choices seem to be influenced by something higher or the controllers of the universe. So it's somehow it feels like, a puppet or something, a helpless puppet, where be it the present or the future seems to have been carved on stone. So so it makes me question, what exactly is my potency or potential as Krishna's potency? Yes, Maharaj, that's my question.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so we have free will. Of course, your question is how free is our will? Or that's a question I like to put sometimes because we don't have unlimited free will. I mean, we cannot do everything that we want, anything and everything. And interestingly, in its own way, you can even apply that criteria to God himself. Krishna cannot stop being Krishna. He doesn't have a choice in that. Right? Well, God is made of love. He cannot not love. He's not free to not love because that goes against his very makeup, constitution. So in that sense, you can say he's not absolutely free to do whatever he likes, even God. So if that applies to him, he ought to speak to us, right? Which doesn't mean, again, we should be careful not to fall into black and white thinking. Okay, oh, then that means there's no free will at all. Now, if there's not absolute free will to do whatever I want at any single moment, that doesn't mean I'm a inert puppet. No, nobody's saying that. So we have to again find ourselves comfortable in these mid waters, not one extreme nor the other. So regarding what your this astrologer mentioned, I must respectfully disagree. I don't know him, so I don't or her. I cannot talk about the person. I don't know if the person was trying to sell a session by saying that, like overemphasizing the all-pervadingness influence of planets, because that's not our Siddhanta. That's not our Siddhanta. Nowhere in the Bhagavatam to say that Parikshit Maharaj's enlightenment, so to say, was due to a, so to say, auspicious constellation, right? Because a Vaishnava is beyond that. Once I remember Bhaktisundar Govinda Maharaj was talking with Srila Siddhar Maharaj. Bhaktisundar Govinda Maharaj was his successor, disciple, and eventual acharya, successor acharya. So he was an astrologer. He studied astrology when he was young. And also Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was an astrologer. And he never overemphasized astrology that much, being an astrologer, as you can see in his life and teachings. But once someone was asking Srila Govinda Maharaj about astrology and the influence of the planets, and with this again, don't go black and white. I'm not saying astrology is bogus. I'm not saying that. Just I'm not over absolutizing that either. So someone asked him, What about astrology and the influence of the planets and so on? And he said, in its own ways, he said, well, the thing with astrology is that the most important planet is not included in the chart. And that planet is Golok Vrindavan. Like implying a devotee is someone who puts himself under a certain new planetary influence, so to say. Right? Golokir Prima Dan Harinam Sankirtan, says Narottam Das Thakur. Harinam Sankirtan, the gift of Mahaprabhu, is Golokir Prima Dan, is the gift of love that comes from that planet called Golok. So whomever aligns with Harinam Sankirtan is aligning with that unique planetary influence coming from that planet, which happens not to be included in the chart. Right? So how much you can determine the life of a devotee and the influence in that person in connection to the planets of this universe, so to say. So that's not the same. Krishna says in the Gita, chapter 9, when he defines the devotees, Mahatmas, Mahatmanastu Mampartam, Daivim Prakritim Ashrita. So my devotee is he or she who puts himself, herself under the shelter, under the influence of Daivim Prakritim, of the divine energy or Swarup Shakti, Bhakti. Like implying that people, those people, they are operating on a particular set of planetary influences. We could say everyone is operating by some planetary influence, but you have different planets, no? Spiritual planets, material planets, different influences, different presiding deities. And of course, there are devotees who are still in between, no? Not fully immersed in bhakti. Still some other influences are there, so you can consider all those planetary influences. But going back to the main question, we have free will. There are influences, but the fact that there are influences doesn't mean that we have been devoid of free will. No. Ultimately, I will say like this. I mean, free will doesn't mean that I'm free from all influences. Because the word influence is not a problem. Free will actually means pick your influence. Free will means choose your planetary influence. That's my new fancy way to describe free will from now on. Pick your planetary influence. You want to be influenced by Rahu, Ketu, Saturn, or you want to be influenced by Golok Vrindavan, a mixture of them. So that's free will. Free will is you can choose, because you can choose, all of us can choose, under the shelter of which influence or which energy we want to put ourselves. On a daily basis, I think that's the direct experience of every one of us. I mean, we are not inanimate, inert objects, no? We are not, it's not that everything is predetermined. Although I must confess, I mean, it's not my confession, but there are devotees in the Gaudiya community who think that we have no free will. That's interesting. Of course, I disagree, but they have their own ways of concluding we have no free will at all. And I don't agree. And it sounds even scary because it's reducing the ontology of the soul to an predetermined object, basically. No. And sometimes we have to be careful in how we, and maybe we don't have time today to go into the details of that, but even sometimes in the way we express ourselves in terms of Krishna controls, and Krishna is the supreme controller, and he can do whatever he likes. And sometimes we may see those quotes because everyone is saying them, but we don't figure out the implications of them. Because if you play out some of those ideas to the fullest degree, it can end up as I have no choice whatsoever. At any moment, Krishna can interrupt and do whatever he likes, and he's not respecting my free will. I have no voice, no opinion. And that's not nice. That's not loving, basically. If I'm relating with someone which at any moment can jump onto my own free will and cancel it by his own will, how much is a loving relationship? Because love entails voluntary choice and investment in that reality, in that connection. So we have to make to come to terms in how we express ourselves, how we think of Krishna, because we may say, yeah, there is free will, but at the same time, we may say things in terms of at any moment, Krishna can do whatever he likes, and I have no voice whatsoever. So that means you have no free will then. So you have to harmonize, reconcile that, or understand those quotes in a nuanced way, or stop using those words. Do you follow my point? So I think it's important because in many of our Gaudiya lingo, we may invoke some of these ideas, which sometimes are not even in the scriptures, but just have been passed on in the oral tradition, which is not precisely parampara in this case, but some other oral tradition. And you just like, okay, yes, everyone is saying that, so I have to repeat that. But again, how does those things impact on my free will? We have to reconcile. That's over and over again mentioned in Shastra, Tattu Samambayat. We have to put everything in the scale in such a way that things are reconciled, not that one thing cancels the other. Not, scripture says here, there is free. This Jiva has free will, and also the scriptures say Krishna is the supreme controller. Okay, so how Krishna can be the supreme controller without canceling my free will? You follow that, this type of thinking we have to have develop in terms of scriptural understanding, because scriptures say Jivas have free will. Scripture says Krishna is supreme controller. So we cannot just cherry pick one of those to the point that one is canceling the other. That's not how Shastra is to be understood. But we have to incorporate all of them, integrate all of them in a way that they are complementing, harmonizing, integrating, and not like killing each other, so to say. Or we end up saying a whole bunch of contradictory things one after another. And as we say before, if that's our foundation, on that basis we are practicing. So what will be the fruit of that practice? So yeah, there is free will. It's not unlimited, because as I even told you, Krishna himself cannot do everything or cannot not do certain things. And he is God. You get it? So, but that doesn't mean, again, the extreme of we are predetermined substances with no choice whatsoever. There is a choice, and the choice is under which Shakti do I choose to put myself? Now, Jivas, in order to retain our experience of individuality, we have two choices. I experience my individuality under the influence of Maya Shakti. I experience my individuality under the influence of Swarup Shakti. Those are the two options, basically, if you want to boil down free will to that. If you don't want to put yourself under any of those two influences, the third remaining option is you enter Brahman, but you lose your experience of individuality. So if you want to remain an individual, experiential individual, you have to choose between these two influences. If you want no influence whatsoever, okay, you have no influence, but you have no individuality as well. So there is a price to pay for remaining under no influence whatsoever, if you want to put it like that, of course. So there's not a problem with being influenced by something. The thing is to pick the correct influence. So I want to be influenced by love. I mean, to fall in love means to be influenced by love. To love Krishna means to be influenced by love. He's influenced by love profoundly, extremely. So again, God is influenced. God is partial. He's impartial in one sense, but he's partial at the same time. We know that. So again, we have to come to terms with these ideas. As God has free will, and God has free will, which doesn't mean he can do whatever he wants, as we explained, but which implies that he's influenced by certain Shakti and so on. And he becomes partial in certain direction while remaining impartial. So on some level, all those principles also can apply to us. We have free will in our own way, not like Krishna's. And the scope of our will, of course, the more enlightened we are and the more we pick the right influence, sort of Shakti, Bhakti, the more the expression of our will becomes more informed, more clear, more empowered. And we will be carried by that influence, by love. The less we have, that will be carried by the gunas, as we know. That's basically the influence. Which type of the free will is, which type of influence do you want you to be carried by? Yeah, that's not the problem. The problem is when we choose in the wrong direction. That's basically it, right? So that's what I will say regarding free will, astrology, and some other related topics. Of course, there is so much that can be done, and there are books written on the topic of will and agency, even from different perspectives, Vaishnava and other sampradayas, and so many more things, but just to keep it hopefully simple and understandable. So I don't know. I hope that helps, Natan Chidra.
Yes, Maharaj, that was wow. So I've taken down, and I think I'll revisit this in the recording. So if I have any further clarifications to be done, I'll bring that up then, Maharaj. But thank you so much. This was a wonderful answer.
Thank you.
And if there are any like references you had mentioned on Vaishnavs having written, so if there are such references,
maybe you can recall me by private message and I can send you something.
Sure, Maharaj, sure. Thank you very much, Maharaj.
Thank you, thank you. Okay, there is Madhav raising his hand, and I think we will conclude with his question since we have some engagements here. So please, Madhav, you can unmute yourself.
Maharaj, pranam, Maharaj.
Pranam.
First of all, Maharaj, I would like to thank you for the last week's answer you gave about that japa question which I asked you. So I have been listening to that over and over again, and it has helped me a lot in my personal practice of both japa and kirtan. So my question for today is from the last lecture which you gave about self-love. So in that lecture you said that it is very important to identify when we say, let's say we say I love you, so we need to know, we need to identify what we mean by I, what we mean by love, and what we mean by you.
Mm-hmm.
And you also quote section from Bhagavad Gita from the second chapter where Krishna says that Ashcharyavat verse wherein he says that the soul is Ashcharyavat. So therein Krishna is speaking about the soul being Ashcharyavat. And at the same time, when we say that I love myself, so the self is basically the soul. So in a sense, we are to love the spiritual aspect of ourselves. So, but we also have aspects about ourselves which are not very spiritual, which are not very congruent with spirituality, which are like directly opposing our engagement in spirituality. So how do we love those aspects of ourselves, or what do we do with those aspects within ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Of course, the answer, and I imagine you can imagine what will be my answer, but I'm not proposing here, I don't know, you detect that you have certain dysfunctional aspect of your psychology and you love that, no? And you're like violent or envious or dualistic and just fall in love with all of that, no? Because again, that's not you. No, that's not you. That's not the Atma and its potential. That's something that still is getting in the way of that. So when we say self-love, we are talking about the self, the actual self, right? the Atma and its potential. That said, of course, there is a body, psychic body, material body, and we are in the process, as bhaktas, in the process of spiritualizing that. There is a sadaka deha and so on. So there's place for loving all that. No, there's place for loving all that. Again, not in a narcissistic way, but in a, in a wholesome way. No, like this is a gift. I receive sadaka deha. No, my mind and my body, I'm in the project of invoking bhakti in my life. So every pore of my body becomes imbued with bhakti samskaras, devotional impressions. So the more that happens, or as much as that happens, that's lovable, so to say, right? And those aspects of my psyche, if you want to put it like that, that become influenced by bhakti, I mean, there is place to appreciate that, to care for that, to love that, if you want to use that word. And whatever is getting still getting in the way of that, I wouldn't say you have to hate that, no, and reject that, and because that's not very practical, in my opinion. You have just to be compassionate and detect that and integrate those aspects and into their proper expression, so to say. You know, like if there is some fears, there's whatever tendency we know is not an enlightened one. Okay, approach that particular aspect of your present personality. Try to understand from where this is coming, no, with compassion, no, from where this is coming. I'm, this is not me. I'm not over-identifying with that, but that's there. And somehow I'm still identified at times with that. But if I think for a minute, I know I'm not that, but somehow that's still there. So where does this coming from? How to deal with that? How to integrate that in my bhakti project? How to purify that tendency and take it to its natural expression with Krishna in the center? And in that sense, I will say that's a way of loving all those layers, so to say, that in one sense are not very lovable, you could say, but it's a way of caring, paying attention to that, which is a form of love, so to say, paying attention to that from a compassionate place and trying to integrate those tendencies in the proper way. I will say that what we may call anartha is just like misdirected energy, basically, or misdirected tendency. So it's that same thing expressing its proper direction. That's no longer anartha, it's artha. Artha means value, something valuable. So anartha means I'm just investing this particular tendency in a dualistic direction, in an illusory direction. So I need just to recalculate and use that energy and that tendency, try to express it with the center, no? Like Prabhupada will give the example of the one. Krishna is the one, everything is a zero. So I try to bring Krishna into the picture and find this particular expression, take it to its natural expression. So whatever anarthas we have, they are just distorted expressions of things that could be expressed in a healthy way. So that's our challenge. That's anartha nibriti, basically. Anartha nibriti is not just, I'll keep chanting my rounds and all this crap is going out of my life. Something like that. Sometimes devotees may address the practice from that spirit. It's more about how I can redeem these tendencies, how I can find the proper ideal expression of this thing, whatever it is, in service to Krishna. Again, that's bhakti. Nothing needs to be rejected. Everything needs to find its proper place of integration. Mm-hmm. So for me, that would be a way of showing self-love, so to say, with those things which are not myself, but which in potential are tendencies that can be integrated into my personality, and that personality eventually can become fully spiritualized in bhakti, and that fully spiritualized personality can become part of my eternal identity, as we talked many times in the past also. So in that way, you can tie the whole thing to your ultimate self. Your ultimate spiritual identity will have certain aspects of your personality which were present in your sadhaka body, so to say, were properly integrated, properly expressed, fully spiritualized, to the point that they are accompanying you in transcendence. But again, we have to begin somewhere. So I will say that somewhere is, yeah, facing those tendencies, call it like that, with care, with compassion, no? Like trying to understand them, not demonizing, not stigmatizing, not in need of doing that with others or with ourselves, because we can choose to orient our life in that way also. Like Nartas are demons and they're attacking us and we have to fight against them and we develop all this like warlike paradigm. And again, it reinforces generally lots of dualism. It's us and them, us against them. Someone is trying to, you can see Maya, like she wants me to fall down instead of, no, she's a Vaishnavi serving Krishna better than you. Right? And so on and so forth. So at the end of the day, like Srila Silmara said, you will realize there are no enemies. There are no enemies. The only enemies, the pattern that makes me think that there are enemies. But when I solve that in my own mind, there are no enemies. So in that sense, we can, at least in theory, although we may not have the realization, but in theory, conduct ourselves from that place. Now, knowing that in theory, I know there are no enemies. I know that everything can be used in service of Krishna. All this energy and tendency that now is misdirected, and I call that anartha, I can reinvest that in a proper way, and that can empower me instead of disempower me like it's happening now, so to say. That same energy that is disempowering me, properly channeled and expressed, will be a source of empowerment. So I just need to figure out how to do that, how to understand what's the background of that particular anartha, how to express that energy. And that's what we mean by bhajan kriya, by engaging in bhajan with vigilance, with introspection, with thinking together, with sincerity, and trying again not to reject anything. Bhakti is not about rejection. It's about integration. So I will say that's another expression of self-love. Yeah, in connection to your particular question, yeah.
So basically, it's like if somebody is taking care of their bodies, so they also clean up their bodies. So similarly, it's like cleaning up our psyche. So that's an expression of self-love.
Yeah, we don't need to reject anything. Again, body is not to be rejected. It's an energy of Bhagavan. Krishna is inhabiting every atom. So every atom is worshipable. So why need to reject that? It just need to be acknowledged, that fact. You have to acknowledge, to allow matter to be what it is in your life, a sacred energy, which is not separated from God. And the same with psychic energy. It's just energy, psychic, physical, call it. It's all energy, it's all potency. And potency has potential. So now sometimes we are just missing potential, basically. So we need to just allow all potencies to show their potential in the proper direction. And we have free will for that. if not, we are just experiencing missed potential. That's what we may call anartha. That's another way of putting anartha. Misdirected potential, misread potential. When you learn to do it, to express it is no longer anartha, it's artha. Here, Anuttam Chitra is quoting something by Carl Rogers, very interesting author, by the way. Say, the curious paradox is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. So yeah, again, it's very important to have that type of acceptance, even if I'm still identified with my psychic movements and I'm still partial and limited in so many ways. First, you have to accept that fact. In order to change that fact, you cannot change a fact that you haven't not accepted first. And you have to accept that with compassion, no, not with resignation and self-loading, and because that's not acceptance. You are not accepting anything in that moment. You just keep rejecting. If you say, I accept that I have this, which is so hateful, and I reject it so much, that's not acceptance. You are not accepting anything. So real acceptance is accepting those facts with compassion, with care, and on that foundation, for the purpose of change. Again, not accepting that as an excuse to over-identify with that and remain as such. No. I'm accepting that because I want to grow and improve and mature and change. But first, radical acceptance. So that's another way of self-love. Yeah, so many expressions of self-love in bhakti that we can talk about. So. Thank you for the question, Madhav. I appreciate it. It's a further reflection on the topic. Of course, I'm talking this day, so it keeps the whole dynamics rolling, so to say.
Thank you so much, Madhav.
Thank you. Thank you to all of you. And there are no questions, more questions. And also, there's time here to leave. We have to do some other things today. So my pleasure, as usual, to be with all of you in Ishtagosti, trying to orbit and constellate around this common Ishta, this common center, our non-dual reality, and so on and so forth, expressing our free will in the context of self-love in bhakti. And looking forward, see you next Saturday. But of course, you are invited to connect later for those who can, according to their local timings, today, tomorrow, for the lectures we will be sharing. I hope you were able to watch our podcast with Rich Aurora. That was beautiful. And you can watch it again if you want. No harm. I'll do myself. So thank you so much. See you very soon. Thank you for your presence. And Sangha in Tadatmya. Sri Man Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu ki jai. Sri Sri Gaur Nityananda ki jai, Sri Sri Gaur Gadadhar ki jai, Sri Sri Radha Manmohan ki jai, Radha Govinda Dev ki jai, Radha Gopinajju ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrind ki jai, Sri Ekadasi ki jai. Gaur Pramananda Hari Bo.
Jai
Bhakta Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyai Vacha. Patitanam Pavanevya Vaishnavibhya Namo Namah. Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrind ki jai. Gaur Hari Bo.